CityCast from Explocity.
A man called Wolfgang Schmidt had appeared at the Pedi as if out of nowhere. Nobody could remember the last time a European had been seen at Mulji Jetha Market, and there were many sidelong glances and wide-eyed stares as Schmidt wandered down the lanes and crossroads of the market. At any time, a European strolling about in the market would have led to much surprise, but Schmidt's appearance created a positive buzz of amazement because he was a gigantic man. With his luxuriant blonde beard and moustache and wavy hair covering his ears and neck, he had the appearance of a shaggy but affable giant. He smiled amicably around him at the staring people, almost appearing to enjoy being the center of attention. Tatya saw him pass by his pedi one afternoon as he sat there examining some cloth samples and stared in astonishment as the man paused, looked up and down the lane, and then turned back to head straight towards Tatya's pedi. "I am looking for Mr. Govinda Bhyankar," he said, politely in perfect English. His accent was not that of an Englishman, however. "My name is Wolfgang Schmidt, of Germany." Tatya and Kishan Mehta gaped up at him, feeling dwarfed. Finally, Tatya said, "You've come to the right place. How may I help you?" "I have heard that you are in the process of erecting a pleasure palace, a place of entertainment. Am I correct?" "No," said Tatya, "that is not quite correct. I am about to open a bioscope theatre, that is all." "But that is exactly what I mean," exclaimed Schmidt. "It will be a place where people come for pleasure, for recreation and relaxation, yes?" Tatya nodded, bewildered. "I have for you a proposition. Will you please come with me?" "Come with you? Where?" said Tatya. "I am rather busy, you see, and I've heard you are a man of culture who appreciates music and the arts. That you've already hired a troupe of musicians to play newly composed music, songs created especially for your films. If you will come with me, I would like to show you something magnificent, which will be of benefit to both of us." The man's reticence at saying what exactly he wanted to show was puzzling, but Tatya was intrigued. Schmidt seemed to think that the greater a mystery he made of it, the more likely it was that Tatya would come to see whatever it was he wanted to sell. He went with Schmidt, who had a landau waiting outside the market. They drove to a small lane off Flora Fountain and walked through an entrance into a building and into a large chamber. And here was the most extraordinary contraption that Tatya had ever seen. "This," said Schmidt with a flourish, "is the thing you need to transform your theatre into a true palace of pleasure. I present to you the superlative and sumptuous Oriental organ, made of the finest wood from the Black Forest, crafted by the renowned firm of Gebruder Bruder in Waldkirch in Germany." "An organ," said Tatya, nonplussed. "But I don't see any keys for anyone to play it. I don't need an organ, Mr. Schmidt. I run a theatre, not an orchestra." "This is not that kind of organ. And once you own this, you will have no need of an orchestra, I assure you. Would you like to hear it?" "Presumably, the thing plays some kind of music," thought Tatya, staring at it. It had clearly been fashioned with love and care. It was enormous, taller than even Schmidt, and took up almost an entire wall of the room. And it was shaped like a splendid Oriental palace, exactly like something Bhalerao, in one of his frenzies of inventiveness, might order Mistry the carpenter to erect as a set. Except this palace came in full colour, and apparently with grand orchestration to boot.
The essence of historical fiction is to tell stories set in a particular period of time. They transport us to a different place, offering insights into the past while exploring themes that are relatable across generations. Now, in the craft of historical fiction, authors take creative liberties with places, events, and characters, using all of those as foundations for their stories. Here are some noteworthy examples. Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, War and Peace, Tolstoy, The Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett, Great Gatsby, Fitzgerald, and among such works most discussed, of course, is Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. One of the few Indian writers who have attempted such a huge span of time in a novel is my guest today, Tejaswini Apte Ram. Her debut novel, The Secret of Moor, unfolds in colonial Bombay and spans 50 years, 1899 to 1952. As an aside, another such notable work is David Davidar's The House of Blue Mangoes, featured in my conversation with him in an earlier episode on this podcast. There's a link in the podcast description. Tejaswini's story captures the transformation of Bombay under British rule from a mercantile center to a busy metropolis, and the emergence of a vibrant movie industry starting with silent movies. It is against this intriguing backdrop that she unravels the story of a young man named Tatya, who is driven by a relentless desire for more success. Tatya is modeled after Tejaswini's great-grandfather, and she crafted his character and that of early Bombay through extensive research, including the oral histories of her family. Now, it's easy to understand why The Secret of More has captured the attention of critics like myself and many others. There's something truly compelling about this novel that draws you in and keeps you there. Maintaining a charged narrative across 5 decades is not easy, but Tejaswini does it well. Deservedly, her book just won the Tata Literature Live First Book Award for Fiction 2023, and at the time of this recording, it has been shortlisted for both the JCB and the Atagalata Awards. The JCB Award is to be announced around the time that this episode will go live. I invited her on this podcast to get a look at her creative process. So here she is joining me from her home in Pune, Tejaswini Apte Ram. Welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your latest book, The Secret of More, has been described as a debut novel. But to me, you don't seem like a debut novelist.
I've written a lot. It's my 6th book, but my first novel. When I started, I had very little idea of how to actually go about writing a novel, but I'd done a lot of other writing before.
And how did you hack a novel?
The way I wrote the novel was to simply teach myself by reading a lot about writing.
Read what exactly?
I read Anne Lamott, Bird by Bird. Mm-hmm. And I read The Portable MFA in Creative Writing by the New York Writers Workshop. That was invaluable because it actually talked in great detail about how a novel should be structured and planned. And especially with a novel of this size and length, planning and structuring was absolutely essential.
Right. Craft. So let's talk about craft. For you, what drives your writing? Muse or Master Sergeant?
I think the Sergeant. I think that's just the way I work. I work with a lot of focus. And so I'm a sort of drill master to myself. I make myself sit down at a particular time every day in the morning and not get up till I've written for 2 hours or 1,000 words or 1,500 words or whatever my goal is during that period of time.
That's quite a bit of discipline.
I don't know how else one would actually finish a book. If you wait for the muse, there's. I think you've got to force the muse, grab her by the wrist and make her come and sit with you. You know, it's not her book, it's not her novel, it's my book and my novel. So I need to show up. I need to show up for work. And only then can I hope for her to show up to work as well. And so I don't really have this very romantic notion of writing, you know, locking yourself up in a garret and and writing. I don't know who on earth could manage that and also live their lives.
Good advice for aspiring writers. So let's talk about craft. In The Secret of More, this novel spans a time of considerable amount of time, doesn't it? What was it, 60 years?
50 years, approximately.
That's halfway to Marquez already, isn't it?
It was a challenge to do that, especially because I'm jumping back and forth in time as well. And if we're talking about craft, this was really difficult to plan.
Give me an example.
I had to write everything down to make sure that I wasn't goofing up on timelines and who is doing what at a particular time, what is happening in that particular year in terms of the social context, the political context, the business context. I had to make sure that I didn't have a sort of hair out of place. So there was a very elaborate structure and timeline that I had to make. And that was the way I managed that structure.
Most impressive. So before this novel was published, you published a book of short stories titled These Circuses That Sweep Through the Land. Although there was not much time lapsed between that book and The Secret of More, I sense a qualitative change in your writing.
So I think the genre that I was writing in dictated the style of writing. And so I think both genres called for very different sensibilities. I was very influenced, I would say, by the adult stories of Roald Dahl. Whereas when I wrote the novel, I think I was very conscious that I was sort of taking on the format of a sort of a grand 19th century novel, you know, a vast canvas on which to paint. And of course, by the time I wrote my novel, I think I was a far more confident writer.
Right. And almost every writer goes through exactly this. Now, in that book of short stories, These Circuses That Sweep Through the Landscape, I'm now referring to the piece that is of the same title. You make an observation in that story that I have felt for a long time. And you're the only other person I know who has made that observation. It's about the backs of people's heads. Your piece opens with these lines, and I quote, "The back of a person's head looks so vulnerable. Everyone looks like a buffoon from the back, slightly pathetic and clueless. The crown of the skull, the base of the cranium, cradled on top of the spine, all exposed and witless." Very noir humor.
I think it's funny as well. I also think it's a bit scary. You always look at yourself in the mirror, you do your hair, and you arrange your expression in a particular way. But there's absolutely nothing you can do about the back of your head.
So how did you intend that passage to go? Funny or scary?
I don't know whether to say funny or sort of maybe even sad or tragic. I don't know. It's just the complete lack of control.
You mentioned Dahl. You do take to the dark side, don't you?
Yes, I tend to have a slightly morbid imagination.
So to you, Happy Halloween is not a contradiction in terms?
Actually, no. I think I'm very happy with the Halloween-type stories. You know, the scary, it makes me happy. This twisty thing makes me happy. I was very thrilled to see in the news just a day or two ago, in fact, I read in The Guardian that scientists have just discovered that the starfish doesn't have five arms, as has been assumed all these years, but that the five arms are in fact an extension of its head.
Yeah, I read that.
So in fact, a starfish is just a disembodied head creeping along the seafloor. And I can't tell you how much that delighted me.
I do like that. Okay, let's move on to your book. The Secret of More. The more refers to human wants and desires, does it?
Yes, I think it's exactly about that. But it's also about the different kinds of more. The protagonist, Tatya, has a very specific vision of what he thinks of as wanting more. He's essentially an ambitious businessman, and he wants more and more of that, more and more success in business. But there are other characters in the book who have a different definition of more. And especially when it comes to his son or even other characters, that creates conflict between Tatya's vision of more and other characters' vision of more.
And the urban landscape of Bombay had a lot to do with the narrative, didn't it?
The inspiration was the city of Bombay, mm-hmm. Which is a place where I feel that people constantly want more, that people are never content. There's a great ambition which the city nurtures, I think. The city is a place, this particular city anyhow, is a place that rewards ambition and risk-taking. And I think it creates a particular kind of mindset among people in Bombay, the need to do more, to be more, to gain more.
The setting of Bombay is also important and relevant, of course, to the story, but also because you capture a slice of the 1920s Bombay that's quite fascinating, the beginning of the silent film industry, and of course, its passage. You must have enjoyed researching that.
I had a lot of fun researching it because I'm a film buff, and I just love the movies. I would spend my life in a movie theater if I could. And so it was fascinating to go back to those early years of the beginning of the film industry. And how amazing to think that at that time, nobody could have predicted what a cultural giant this industry would turn out to be.
Yes, quite true.
In fact, at that time, it was pretty much, it started off as a sort of a cottage industry almost. with Dada Saheb Phalke enlisting the help of his wife to wash the film in a fountain in the courtyard to develop it and so on. So I think the filmmakers of that time, they were just winging it. They were making things up as they went along, discovering the technical possibilities, the creative possibilities of storytelling. A fascinating nugget of information that I came across was when Babu Rao Painter used fireworks to light up a nighttime battle scene because he didn't have the access to electricity. That was sometime in the 1920s. So this kind of constant organic sort of evolution of methodologies, of this real explosion of creativity that this new technology allowed. And on the flip side, looking at it from the point of view of the audience, this new technology gave them the possibility to dream and imagine and live other realities in a way that had simply never happened before. It was not so long ago that people had never seen a picture move. It seems incredible to think of it now. But the technology allowed a different kind of dreaming to happen. And that's what I found so fascinating about it.
As any period novel should do, The Secret of More has quite the sweep to it. You deal with many subjects woven in business, marriage, child rearing, social customs, women, and so on. But I would like to talk about your main protagonist, Tatya. You have him coming across as self-assured and stoic, and then immediately also surprised and curious. It reminds me a little of R.K. Narayan's characters at the time. So in the epilogue that you mentioned that the character of Tatya is modeled on your great-grandfather. So how did you come upon this character? Did your family preserve records? Was there a lot for you to see and research? And importantly, what drove you to it?
So the reason I started doing all the research that went into the novel was not for writing a novel, but for writing my great-grandfather's biography. That was the original project. And I knew the basic plot of his, what happened in his life, but I wasn't content with that. His life, I felt, didn't really make any sense to me unless I dug into the history behind it. Why he made certain decisions, what really was the textile industry like, what really was the silent film industry like. What was it? I wanted to see him move through that landscape almost in a cinematic way, and I felt that was the only way I would really be able to understand his life. And the reason I became interested in him in the first place is because I was told that his favorite grandchild was my father. And so that was the first spark of interest. I was like, oh, I want to know more about him. And the more I came to know, the more I thought his life had taken on an incredible trajectory, almost a rags-to-riches story. But the family didn't have consolidated information about him. I did a host of oral interviews with many family members, hours and hours of recordings, which I transcribed. And most surprisingly, there was zero information about his very prolific career as a silent film producer. And that was because at some point he felt, in reality, he felt that this was an occupation that would not be a good influence on his children and grandchildren. And so one still doesn't know why exactly he got out of the industry after producing about 100 films. But the fact remains that he thought it was a completely undesirable influence. And so he never ever spoke about it to the family, which is why nobody ever knew any details at all. So the few references I had in my oral interviews were very vague or simply incorrect. And I only dug further into it because I'm a real film buff, perhaps the only one in my family. And so I went to the National Film Archives, I dug around, and the only reason that any information about him has survived is because he was in fact the financier of Dada Saheb Phalke, who is known as the father of the film industry. And via that route, the information has survived. So if he was associated with a less celebrated character, probably the information wouldn't have survived. But as it was, he was one of the founding members of the Hindustan Film Company, which produced many of Phalke's films, and went on to produce about 100 films with or without Phalke.
That is fascinating. And fascinating also because I think it's an important piece of Bollywood history. And speaking of history, your acknowledgements reads like a bibliography or references. I'm interested to know why you found the need to include so many references in the acknowledgements. Are you boiling up to write a more academic book about this?
I'm a writer who comes from a research background. So my first two books were very research-based. They were environmental books. One was on biodiversity planning. Another was on intellectual property rights.
Right.
And biodiversity and traditional knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the kinds of books that required extensive bibliography and referencing. I just thought it would be interesting for readers to know where the information comes from and to know that this is very much based in history, though the story is fiction, but the history is very well researched.
So does historical fiction interest you? Are you planning to write any more?
I would love to, except that it was a huge undertaking, so I should probably take a little bit of a break.
Maybe write something funny, maybe about the backs of people's heads.
I'd like to write something more along those lines of those short stories, something twisty and dark and access that side of my personality again.
When I started to read your book, I also dipped into a book I had read many years ago, which was Govind Narayan's urban biography of Bombay. I think you mentioned it in your references. Then your novels started to become way more relatable to me. History of Bombay, does it interest you?
It does interest me, but not just from a historical point of view. I have no particular interest in just reading about Bombay for the sake of it. I'm interested in people's stories.
Yes, that's understandable. And also understandable because of the ease with which you have raw emotion in your book. You know, like any self-respecting literary novel, it has to have its share of disillusionment, doesn't it? And then there's this line of yours that I read in an essay that you had written somewhere that I can't remember where, and it closes your piece on your feelings on the death of the actor Rishi Kapoor, and the line, and I quote, "When I cry for a lost star, I am crying in the end about youth, about mortality." Quite compelling, nicely written.
Thank you. Yes, I think I'm not afraid to dip into my own emotions or the memory of my own emotions and bring that out onto the page. And as far as that particular line is concerned, I felt it really did encapsulate the sense of melancholy and loss, because when a star dies, what really are we crying for? In this case, I was writing about the passing away of Rishi Kapoor. I never knew him. I never even met him as a fan. So why did I feel so bad and so melancholy? And I think the melancholy is related to our memories of ourselves and the passing of a certain time in our own lives when that star passes on.
When I started to read Secret of More, I read it in one sitting, for one thing, because I had to, and second thing, is because I felt like it was like binge-watching a TV series, a completely enjoyable book.
You know, that is really high praise. Thank you so much for that.
And it was a complete pleasure speaking with you today. Totally enjoyed myself. Tejaswini Apte Ram, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you so much. I've loved talking to you. It's been so nice.
You've been listening to Tejaswini Apte Ram. There's a link in the podcast description to where you can find yourself a copy of her book. And now it's time for our fun, popular etymology segment, What's That Word?, where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. Right after this. Well, I do. do hope you enjoyed that ad or that piece of music, whatever you were served up. Anyway, it's What's That Word? And here she is, my co-host.
Hello, my name is Pranithi, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
P with an A, right here and looking very accomplished today.
I look accomplished? Well, that's from reading too much, I'll tell you.
As long as one of us does.
Happy to fly the flag. Hey, nice session with Tejaswini.
Thank you.
Seemed like you liked her book.
I liked her, liked her book. She's cool.
Yeah, writing across a 50-year time span must be a tough one.
Not easy, for sure. Okay, P with an A, let's do this. What's that word?
I want to know if we can spend some time on something we've not done before.
Oh, no.
No, it's a good thing. Let's read out some of the letters we've received and reply to them.
Oh, we're doing that? Cool. But what letters?
Only the ones related to this segment. What's that word? You know, not the responses to the interviews.
Okay, sounds good. Go ahead.
And only a few of them, okay? Some of them have asked some questions.
Let's do it.
Great. So this one is from a gentleman from Mumbai who writes, Dear P with an A and Ramji.
I get second billing. What a gentleman, your man from Mumbai.
Truly. Anyway, he writes, I truly enjoy your podcast and I'm one of your keen followers. I have a question relating to the etymology of the word Messiah that you guys discussed on the show featuring Akar Patel. I love your explanation, but I want to know if the word mess, as an officer's mess, has anything to do with the same roots.
Okay, does he ask anything else?
He says a few more things about the podcast, heartwarming stuff, but this is the part that we discuss.
All right, before we start, how many letters are we going to do today?
As many as we will fit on this page.
Okay, fine. The short version then. Here goes. The mess in officer's mess has nothing to do with the part of the word mess in Messiah, which has to do with crocodile fat, which is the etymology of Messiah, right? But But this one, this officer's mess, comes from Old Latin through French for the word for a meal that is served.
Cool, but how?
So the root of mess in Old French mets is portion of food. It's what it means, and it comes from the Latin mittere, which means to send or to put. And the modern French verb of that is mettre, to put. So the original sense being a course of the meal put on the table.
Ah, I get it. That's interesting. So are there variations?
Well, it has become military knowledge in the armed forces of many nations. And, you know, it refers to a dining area for the officers or others. But to your question, the food association with putting it on the table is also used commonly in the food business. You've heard of mise en place, haven't you?
Heard it. Done it.
Yeah, you were in that business, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, some years ago, a friend in the army, a major, told me that the word mess is an acronym of members of equal social status, M-E-S-S.
I don't think so. Social status in the army? No. And it doesn't measure up to the history of this word, as I mentioned it, does it?
No, it seems forced. Anyway, I'll tell my pal.
Careful, he must be even more senior now.
No, he quit the army.
I hope he didn't become a grammarian.
Hey, stop. He's probably listening.
His identity is safe with you.
I have one friend in the army, and now all my friends have heard it. How did this go from an innocent question to one of my friends being totally twitted?
Right. Isn't that what we do here, twit people?
Yeah, only my friends, it seems.
Victims all. You're welcome. Okay, next.
Okay, so here's one from a lady in Mauritius.
Nice, been there, magic place.
Wow. So is it true that the toilet water flushes counterclockwise south of the equator?
No, it doesn't. Much to my disappointment, it did not. You know, I found out that in small water systems like a flush toilet or the kitchen sink or a wash basin and so on, it depends on the direction of the water jets and the overall design itself of that water system. It has nothing to do with the Earth's rotation and the geolocation of the of the world, unless you're talking about a big thing like, you know, nature catastrophe or thereabouts.
Well, did you flush the toilet many times to check?
Have you heard of the great water shortage of 1998 in Port Louis, Mauritius?
Oh, dear. So, Isabel Leclerc, that's her name.
No kidding.
Isabel asks if there are any words that went from English to French. So she writes to you, "Dear Ramji, I have listened to the Literary City ever since you featured Shakespeare and Company in Paris. I noticed that you speak French, so I have this question. Mm-hmm. For decades, we French people have been criticized for using English words. But I have these doubts. First, there seems to be no problem with so many French words in English. Why not? Don't the English care? And second, how come there are not older English words in French? We only have le weekend, le sandwich, and and we have McDonald's. These are only recent words."
She wrote this letter in English?
No. Elle l'a écrit en français. J'ai traduit cette lettre.
Oh, you translated it. Very good. Pay with an R.
Thank you. I wanted to impress our Francophone listeners.
I'm sure you did. Now to the answer. Yes, there are English words in French, and all of them are not recent, like le weekend and le sandwich. And this has happened over time. So historically, in 1066, the Norman conquest, William the Conqueror took over England. And that brought a lot of Norman French influence into English, and vice versa, because it's not a one-way street, never is. So for centuries, English and French kept impacting each other because of history, politics, and culture. So Isabel, you're asking what words did the French take from English? Well, many. Let me give you some examples from the medieval times, and these include beef, treason, royalty, table, jury, prince, and war. There are many more. And thank you for writing in.
Wow. I did not know that. War, treason. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, beef is the one good thing on the list.
You mean such as to eat?
Eat. Well, okay.
Oh, man. Quel double entendre. Please spare me your depravity.
Okay, do we have time for another?
Oh, you have more?
I've shortlisted many more, but no, I'm being given the slice your throat sign.
All right, next time then. Let's do this letters thing again. I like it. Do you have more?
Loads.
Are there? How come I never get to see these nice letters? I only see the ones from the trolls is all I'm shown.
Because, oh, look at the time. Gotta go. Bye.
And that is our show. I'd like to thank my guest Tejaswini Apte Ram, my co-host Pranathi P with an A, Madhav, and the fans who wrote in, Isabel Leclerc from Mauritius and the gentleman from Mumbai. And not the least, all of you for being here, for listening, for subscribing, for those likes and those wonderful, wonderful comments. Keep them coming. That's why we do the show. Till we meet again, have a wonderful time. This is Ramji Chandran, and this is the Literary City.